Jenny Lawson, our last guest today, is possibly the best read popular writer in the world on mental illness. She's had she's a number one New York Times best-selling author, and she's created a very successful website called The Blog S, which consists of personal conversations, basically, and those conversations chronicling her life and having people react and interact are conducted with panache and huge humour. She seems to find joy even in a life that can be racked with anxiety and depression. And Jenny also has an autoimmune condition producing severe arthritis. She's talked about sometimes feeling safe only in bookstores, or sometimes even the big freezer in her house where she retreats to read. She runs a bookshop herself, a very successful one in San Antonio, Texas, but it has never opened its doors to customers. Jenny does get desperate. She never saw anyone except her immediate family for 6 months during the pandemic, and of course, there is always time for writing. Jenny Lawson's new book is called Broken in the Best Possible Way. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
How lovely to chat.
Oh my gosh, greetings from the other side of the world.
It is really. At the start, you're not hiding under your desk as you talk to us.
I am not. Although I will say it has been sort of lovely that, you know, with the pandemic and quarantine, it kind of worked out for me. I mean, not that COVID is good, like it was awful and, you know, my grandma died of it and it was like not fun, but there have been some really great little silver linings. And one of those is that I don't have to travel and I don't have to physically go onto shows. Like it really works with my anxiety disorder.
You've been diagnosed, speaking of that, as a high-functioning depressive with anxiety disorder and mild self-harm issues. That doesn't actually do justice to the scope and the depths of your afflictions or your talents, really. That's not really an adequate description.
It's interesting. Every person has their own journey and their own struggle. And so what, you know, anxiety and depression and, you know, avoidant personality disorder, what that looks like for me is very different than I think what it looks like for other people. You know, you're supposed to, you know, you sign that like you're going to write a book and then within a year you deliver it. And I'm always, always behind. And this one took me, I think, maybe 5 years because there was this like really deep depression in there that just kept me from doing anything at all. And actually in the middle of writing this book, I ended up going into treatment for my depression. And I thought, well, maybe this will help me. And it did. It was really helpful. But it's interesting because it also became part of the book, sort of accidentally.
Yes, I want to get into that part of the book as well. What it looks like for you is not what it looks like for other people. At the same time, it is, in a sense, similar. I noticed early on in the book you say, for example, everyone seems special to me. That's because I have avoidant personality disorder and imposter syndrome. And I looked avoidant personality disorder up and 1% of the population have it. So, like, for our show, that's about 3,000 people who won't feel as alone anymore now that they know you've got it. And, in fact, what you describe about yourself also describes a big slice of the human race, but just further down the intensity continuum, I think, Jenny, a lot of the time.
Exactly. So I always try to say to myself when I'm in the deepest depths, two things. One is I remind myself that depression lies because it is a terrible liar. And every time that I'm in a depression, and I actually currently am in a depressive episode that I'm, you know, getting help for. And so I'm even at this point, and it's such a strange cognitive dissonance where it feels like, oh, I should be really happy. I mean, things are going well. My book is a bestseller. People are really kind to me. But in my head, all I can think of is I'm a failure. I haven't written anything in the last year and a half. I know that as soon as I come out of this depression, I will be like, oh, that was a horrible lie that my depression was telling me. Why? I would never listen to that. But there's just something about once you're in there, that those terrible thoughts that anybody else, if anybody else said those things to you, you'd be like, what a jerk. I would never listen to that person. But if it's coming from your own head, you're like, oh, yeah, that seems legitimate.
Jenny Lawson is talking to us, broken in the best possible way. In your book, Furiously Happy, there is this quote which you just alluded to in a way. I've often thought that people with severe depression have developed such a well for experiencing extreme emotion that they might be able to experience extreme joy in a way that normal people also might never understand. Or they might not, Jenny. And therein lies the courage, doesn't it? And isn't the courage amazingly praiseworthy in itself, just getting through what the sort of things that you describe?
Yeah, it really is. And it's hard to, when I look at other people who are going through the same thing, I can look at them and say, you survived the day. Like if all you did was hold onto the couch and keep breathing, that's something that should be celebrated. But it's really hard to do it on your own. But then when I do come out, I really grasp onto what can I possibly do during these up periods, the times when it's not so awful, so that it equals out.
And it has silver linings. You talk about your daughter, who you have always had to worry about, as well as yourself and your husband. And what it meant was, when you were feeling incapacitated and really depressed, what it meant was that you could spend a lot of time with her, and that's what she remembers, not how you were feeling, but how great it was having you as a companion.
That is exactly right. They actually recently came out as non-binary, so I'm trying to change all my gendered language, so I'm hoping I'm not going to screw it up. But yeah, there were so many periods of time where all I could do was lay on the couch and I would just be like, okay, well, let's do something that we can do together. Let's, you know, watch Doctor Who. When I look back and I think like, oh, other parents were, you know, taking their kids to brownie meetings and making dinner. And here I was just like watching TV and just trying to survive. And when they got old enough and I was able to, you know, be more open about the struggles that I have and I was able to apologize to them, they were just like, those are some of my greatest memories. Like you weren't, you know, in front of the stove or paying attention to something else, it was just us, you know? And so, you know, I think sometimes we don't give ourselves the credit that we deserve, and we don't give ourselves the same leeway that we would give to people that we love. So yeah, it gave me a really different perspective.
Your memory, or lack of it sometimes, is interesting. And many people may relate to that as well, the things that slip away when you think back into the past that shouldn't have. And I wonder if you've probably thought a lot about this, if that is a byproduct of depression, or, without giving it too much of a label, a byproduct of a worried mind?
You know what? I think it's both. I think they've definitely proven that people with depression have memory problems, for sure. Like basically part of your brain kind of goes dark. So it's all about sort of re-stimulating that or rebuilding those pathways. So part of the my brain that goes dark has to do with memory. So there are just, you know, huge parts of my life that I don't really remember. And it wasn't until maybe 5 years ago or so when I finally saw a doctor who was like, oh no, that's just your depression. So there's other things also not working in your brain. And there's some, you know, parts of your brain that are working like super overtime and they work in fantastic different ways. And then there's some parts that are just, you know, broken,
yes.
Quiet.
Broken. And broken is the book. We're talking with Jenny Lawson. But another blessing is that you forget what you were fighting over with Victor, your other half.
Yes.
And presumably you forget other people's transgressions, unless those are really, you know, heinous. And it's a blessing and a curse at the same time.
In fact, today, Victor came up to me and he was like, "Are you okay? Are you still mad at me about that fight that we had last night?" And I was like, "I have no memory of any fight that we had last night. That's okay. I forgive you. And now we'll move on." So yeah, actually, I think it's pretty helpful sometimes. That's probably why we've been married so long.
In the chapter, I already forgot I wrote this. You talk about a family history of dementia, you know, and how do you look forward and deal with that prospect? Because you have a lot to worry about, even though you've got really good at managing the worry, or at least expert, not always successful, as you say, but expert at managing the worry.
Yeah, there's a couple of things. First of all, I try to do all of the things that might cut down on the chance that I will have dementia. I'm almost positive that I will. My grandparents had it. Their grandparents had it. Their grandparents had it. I do a couple of things. One is I write down things that happen to me all the time. That's actually a big reason why I started blogging and writing my books, is because I wanted there to be a place where there was this like depository of all of these great family stories that I wanted to pass on. And I thought, what if I don't remember them? So that's part of it, is I feel like I can seal a little part of myself into these books so that if I disappear into myself, you could still go to the books and be like, oh, that's who she was. So my grandmother, she started dealing with dementia maybe like 10 years ago, I guess. And she had such joy about it. She had some terrible times too, but she in many ways sort of regressed to childhood and would just be so joyful about the silliest things. And my mom would go and she would take her to Dairy Queen. And every single time my grandmother would be like, "I have not had a Dairy Queen hamburger in 20 years. And meanwhile, my mom's like, "You literally had one 12 hours ago." But she was so overjoyed. And so I just kind of go back and go, you know what? There's probably going to be some joy in that as well.
The things we do to quiet the monsters in your book, and you've referred to it. I just want to ask you a bit more about it. You underwent a procedure that we discussed actually with a neuroscientist on the show, and he was a pioneer of this transcranial magnetic stimulation. So what was it for exactly? What was it like? Did it help?
So it's for treatment-resistant depression, because I have gone through so many different types of medication and none of them really work. So once you've gotten to that point, you kind of go for a little more of the experimental. It just sounded like quackery to me. You know, I mean, you're wearing basically this magnetic hat, and it feels exactly like there is a woodpecker tapping at your head. It is not comfortable. And it sounds like there's absolutely no way that it could work. And they had told me, they were like, the people who do it, about a third of them go into full remission, which I can't even imagine what that looks like. And a third have some improvement, and then a third, it doesn't work at all. And I fell in that middle third. So it really helped me. I did it on both sides of my brain. One side is for depression, one side is for anxiety. It really helped me with my anxiety. It helped me with my depression to come out of a pretty deep depression. But it only lasted for me about 9 months. And I went back in again and did another 6 weeks round. And again, it helped. And again, it lasted about 9 months. And I found that it was really helpful for me, but it does take a lot of time to kind of work. And I'm actually, because I am right now in a really sort of dark spot, my psychiatrist had recommended checking out ketamine injections. Mm. And so that's what I'm actually going to maybe start doing this week. So yeah, you know, whenever people say like, oh, depression isn't real, you know, you're just lazy or you're just sad or you're just tired or whatever, I'm always like, you know what, if depression wasn't real, I would not be paying crazy amounts of money to sit in a chair for 6 weeks while a magnet pounded at my head. I don't know if it's the same in New Zealand, but in America, it is so hard to get not only, treatment, but to get it covered by insurance is just like pulling teeth. And I'm really lucky that I can, just pay for it out of pocket if I need to. But there's so many people who don't have that. And yeah, it just really, it's depressing. It's
I know. Look, I decided not to get into the issues you have with your insurance companies and the medical system in America. But I mean, we have similar complaints, many of them about lack of access to enough mental health help. So I think wherever you are, there's a version of it. I think the difference with you is that you write about all this so wittily. I mean, it's hilarious. You're in the depths of the Slough of Despond, and you're writing sentences like it feels like an invisible chisel drilling holes into your head while you have an ice cream headache, and also you're paying for it to happen to you. And it's so you make it funny.
which I think is actually the thing that makes people who don't deal with mental illness still want to read my books, because they can read them and laugh and still enjoy them even if they don't really understand them, which is really nice. And what's really wonderful is so often I have people who will say, "Hey, I've been reading your books for years and I read them because they were really funny, but I don't have mental illness and I didn't really relate to it, but I just enjoyed your books." And then I, married someone who had mental illness, or my child has mental illness, or this, and it helped me because I was able to say, "Oh, okay, well, here's what I should say, and here's what I shouldn't say, and here are questions I should ask." And it's not just made up. And there's just something about laughing at those monsters that make them, for me, more just easier to deal with.
Jenny Lawson, broken in the best possible way. 6 times I've lost my shoes while wearing them. You lose a lot of things, and you're not alone. You lose your spectacles only to find you're wearing them. You lose vodka only to find it's in your stomach. How come? How do you lose shoes while wearing them? If you could just tell us briefly for people who haven't read your book.
Yes, of course. So I have rheumatoid arthritis, and so that means that sometimes my feet will swell up, and typically one foot swells up more than the other one, and so it stretches out that shoe. And so my two shoes, which I call Thelma and Louise, are it's so often that I'm walking and I kick it out. But the real problem is when you're walking out of like an elevator and you can't get back into the elevator and your shoe goes for a ride. I have lost two shoes in elevators that have just gone on joy rides without me.
Your losing shoes in elevators would make great movie scenes, actually. You described that so funnily. And I assume you would rather not be beset by so much mental and physical misfortune, but then you're a New York Times number one best-selling author because of it. And, well, I mean, it still doesn't sound like a fair trade, but how would you describe that equation? Because in this book, in Broken, is an essay called Sometimes There Is Beauty in Breaking.
Yes, every single person has their own struggle. And so it's just a matter of finding what it is that you're learning from it. And for me, it has been the ability to laugh at things. So for example, when I'm hanging out, if I go out somewhere and people are like, "Oh, that's Jenny Lawson," I always have to apologize to them, because I think that they expect that I'm going to be loud and I'm going to be funny and I'm going to be, but really 99% of the time I sort of disappear because I'm so quiet and all I'm doing is I'm just like listening and thinking, and I'm thinking, "Oh, later on this is going to make a great chapter." But at the time, I think people kind of look at me and go, "Wow, she is so boring. What happened to her?" So, yeah.
The thing is that you sound effervescent in an interview like this, and you look great and friendly and outgoing in the interviews I've seen you do, although I know you don't do many, so I'm grateful that you're doing this for us. So the outsides never reflect your insides. I imagine Victor and Haley see your insides, but no one else really does.
That is exactly right. When I do have an interview that I have to do, for the first part of the day, I do just as little as I possibly can. I read, I just do some basic stuff so I know I'm gonna have energy. And as soon as this is done, I will lay on the floor and just be like, okay, no one touch me. I just need to lay here and, you know, force myself to breathe for a good 45 minutes. And then I'll have the energy to stand up and to, you know, move and get around. And when I first started writing, I had such a hard time because I didn't want to say no to people. Like there were so many, you know, great opportunities and there were so many things. And I had like a nervous breakdown after my first book because I pushed myself too hard.
Tell us about the spoons metaphor, Jenny, that you use, please. The number of spoons in a day, which could be quite helpful.
The spoon theory is super helpful. So it was invented by one of my friends, Christine Miserando, and she has this website called But You Don't Look Sick, and it explains it really, really well. But it's basically about that when you wake up in the morning, especially if you have, chronic pain or an immunocompromised system or mental illness, and I have all three of those. When you wake up in the morning, you will wake up with a certain number of spoons that you can use for different things. So say you wake up and you have 10 spoons, and so you can use one to take a shower, and you can use one to go to work, and you can use one to, and you can kind of go through and look. And then sometimes you say, I have 3 spoons. So if I, you know, get up and take a shower, I will not have enough energy to drive myself to work. Or, you know, if I go to this party, there's absolutely no way that I'm going to be able to take myself back home. And so by looking at the spoons that you're given as a physical thing, not only is that, I think, much more helpful for myself personally, but it's also really helpful. It was the first time that my husband really understood when I said, I don't have enough spoons. Because for him, he has, you know, never ending energy. And he's such an extrovert that when he talks to people, that energizes him.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm just the opposite. As an introvert, like, I love talking to people, but I absolutely know that I will have to recharge by myself in the quiet for at least 2 hours of every hour that I'm going to be talking to people.
Broken by Jenny Lawson, who was talking to us. And if I could just ask you a bit more about that, because I know we think we know the introvert-extrovert split, but all of the reasons why I'm not coming to your party, which is a great chapter heading. You see, millions of people know what you mean, even if you are much further along the continuum. And I don't know if extroverts quite get it. They think, oh, she's shy, or okay, he's awkward. But this is where the spoons come in, because you can do a book tour and be charming to fans and sign books and enjoy meeting them. But in doing so, as you're saying, you sacrifice seeing famous sights of the city you're in that you would like to see. You just go back to the hotel and lie on the floor or whatever you do. That is, when your spoons run out, that's what you have to do.
Exactly. And it's, you know, it can be really disappointing. I wrote a little bit about this. I was actually in New York, and I was doing the book tour, and I already knew that I wasn't going to be able to do anything big, but I thought, because I could see out my window and I could see, like, you know, Times Square, and I thought, I should just go downstairs and just walk out, you know, and just see it. Even if it's just for 10 minutes and then I run back to my hotel room, I should just do this. And I could not get myself to leave my hotel. And I sat there at the door and I felt like such a failure, and I cried, and I just felt like nobody's this level of broken where they can't make themselves just walk. I sat by the window and I opened up the window, which all the hotel room in New York, the windows open, which is very weird to me. But I opened up the window and there was this big fountain below me. The light was hitting the mist and it was creating this rainbow prism. But because of the way that it was being lifted up, it was creating this, it looked like rainbow fire. And I had never seen anything like that before. It was the most amazing thing. And I thought it was so weird that I looked down and I saw all of these people and they were walking by and no one was looking at it. And what I realized is that it was because I was, 10 stories up. That was the reason why I was seeing this prism and the light hit in this certain way, and nobody else was. And so I was able to see this thing that to me is still one of my greatest memories. And the only reason I was able to see it is because I was trapped in my hotel room. And so sometimes even bad things take you to good places.
Well, yes, that's right. And advice, because you must get asked for a lot, how to keep going through a life blighted as yours is by anxiety and depression. Your doctor once said, don't let your pain go to waste, too.
Yes. And what works for me may not work for you. But what I think is so wonderful is so often I will meet up with other people who have anxiety or depression, and I will be like, here's one of my tools. And, 75% of the time they'll be like, oh, yeah, that doesn't work for me. But every once in a while they're like, oh my God, that's going to work for me. And then they'll share with me some of their tools. So, for me, it may be as simple as, if I'm having intrusive thoughts, I will picture the thought and put it in a bubble, like a soap bubble, and just push it away. And it's okay if it comes back, but I'll just rebubble it and push it away. And that's one of those things that has been helpful for me for intrusive thoughts. The phrase depression lies is one of the best tools that has gotten me through because every time I'm in a depression, no matter how many times I go back and read my stuff, and I will, and I'll read it, and I'm saying, it's gonna get better. I promise you, it will get better. And it will be like coming out of the ocean after not breathing for a year, and it will be amazing. And you will be like, thank God I held on. But remembering that when you're in the depression, depression is lying to you. And there's all of these different things that work for me. And so I think it's a matter of finding what works for you and also realizing that if you try a treatment and it doesn't work, you didn't fail the treatment, that treatment failed you. And so what you need to do is just go on and try the next one and try the next one because that's what life is about. I mean, life is about succeeding and failing, and this works and this doesn't work, and margaritas are great. And then maybe some people are like, margaritas are not great for me. And like, you have to find like, margaritas work great for me. And by the way, you probably shouldn't use margaritas as a tool to fight depression. But just sorry, I'm not perfect.
Although
So.
you, yes, that's right. I was going to say you almost certainly have. Jenny Lawson, Broken. What separates you, of course, from the legions of self-help authors and people purveying often useful advice is that you're very funny. You're quite jaundiced about a lot of the advice we hear in all sorts of ways, aren't you?
They say the things like, live every day like it's the last day of your life, except that sounds awful because if somebody said, like, you're gonna die at midnight, I would spend all day terrified and in tears. Like, that's like having fun at gunpoint. So, like, maybe live life like it's Saturday, even when it's like Tuesday afternoon. So, just start slow. That's all.
Having fun at gunpoint.
Right.
What do you want written on your tombstone, as you Americans call that, slab of stone, marking our departure from the world? I mean, maybe not the exact wording, because I'm putting you on the spot, but the sentiment.
I have two thoughts about that. One is that if it's a true testament to my life, I think it should just say Jenny Lawson, well, she tried. But I think what I really want is I'm like, if I'm gonna have this big, granite thing, I would want to like write some sort of mystery on it, right? Like put some sort of like treasure hunt or some sort of riddle or something where people, would be like, oh, okay. And I also, one thing that I have asked was like, I really want a bench instead of a tombstone. And then it'll just be like something like, sit your ass here, and then people can just like hang out and drink and just have a good time because, cemeteries are like really lovely parks, and I think we don't take advantage of them the way that we should.
A riddle is a great idea. I remember going to Yeats, the poet Yeats's tombstone in Northern Ireland, and he has, what does he have? Cast a cold eye on life, on death, horsemen pass by, or something similar, which you just cannot comprehend until you think about it a whole lot and then Google it. So that is a great idea, a riddle. You'll have to work on that.
Right? Yeah. Or like some sort of like alternative, parallel universe thing where people are like, is this a game? Is it real? Who knows? And yeah, something. I'm gonna have to work on it. It's gonna be good.
So after this interview, what will you do? You'll flop down on the floor and say, "Thank God, that's it for the day," and just take recovery time. Is that what you'll do?
That is exactly what I will do.
And perhaps tomorrow you'll remember us with some fondness or not.
I absolutely will because this was so much fun.
It is great to talk with you. Congratulations on your books and your courage and what you've done for a whole lot of people who've found comfort, great comfort in what you write. Very nice of you to talk to us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.